the LGBT community, the environmental community, Planned Parenthood, labor, and groups concerned with civil liberties. I found these meetings to be extremely informative. I believe those who attended felt the same way. As the campaign progressed, this is something we did in other states as well. In late January, I was back in New Hampshire. Arnie Arneson is a well-known political figure in the state and an old friend of mine. Years before, she had run a strong and progressive campaign for governor of the state and later became a host on a radio show that I often called into. Arnie held frequent political gatherings at her home in Concord and was kind enough to hold one there for us. In early February, for the first time, we ventured to Pennsylvania. In Philadelphia, we did a low-donor fundraiser that brought out hundreds of people at $25 a head. The event was held in a large bar. Once again, as we had seen in Evanston, Illinois, I was learning that we could raise a modest amount of money and at the same time have a good-sized event. I was surprised and proud that so many people, working people, were prepared to make a financial contribution to the campaign. The campaign was taking root. In Philadelphia, we also attended a dinner for the House Progressive Caucus, which was chaired by my good friends Congressman Keith Ellison and Raul Grijalva. A number of members of Congress were there. My speech followed that of Lee Saunders, president of the large union, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, AFSCME. While there, I did a number of media interviews. The next day, I was in Harrisburg to speak before the Pennsylvania Progressive Summit. I was joined there by some 800 people. On the way back from Harrisburg to Washington, Michael Briggs and I drove through Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Neither of us had ever visited the Gettysburg Battleground. We stopped there, walked around the grounds, saw a movie at the museum, and talked to some of the park employees. As Vermont soldiers had played a very important role in the Union victory at Gettysburg, I visited the statue of General George Stannard, one of Vermont's military leaders, as well as other Vermont monuments. We also visited the site where Lincoln gave his famous address in 1863. As every schoolchild knows, in his speech, Lincoln stated that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. As we left Gettysburg, it struck me forcefully that what Lincoln had said in 1863 was as relevant today as it was back then, especially with the Supreme Court's disastrous 2010 Citizens United decision that opened the floodgates to virtually unlimited corporate spending in campaigns and allowed big money to buy elections. We were still fighting for a government of the people, by the people, for the people. As a result of that trip to Gettysburg, I often reference Lincoln and what he said there on that day in 1863 in my speeches. In early March 2015, along with many congressional colleagues and President Obama, I visited Selma, Alabama to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the Bloody Sunday March across the Pettus Bridge in the fight for voting rights. The event was organized by Congressman John Lewis, who had been one of the leaders of that demonstration 50 years before as a member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. During that demonstration, Lewis had been brutally beaten and almost killed by Alabama State Police. While in Selma, Jane and I had the opportunity to meet some of the heroes and heroines of that period and of the civil rights movement. These were people who had shown incredible bravery, standing up to official state terrorism, and listening to their stories was a moving and inspiring experience. While there, we also heard some great gospel, one of my favorite kinds of music. We had a great time. Naturally, while we were in Selma, there was a lot of discussion about the state of the civil rights movement, where it had come from, how it had evolved, where it was today. Clearly, everyone agreed, huge and incredibly positive changes had taken place since Lewis and other demonstrators were almost killed in the fight for voting rights 50 years before. Today, Lewis was no longer a demonstrator. He was a U.S. congressman from Georgia, serving with dozens of other African-American members of Congress. 50 years before, African-Americans in Selma didn't have the right to vote. Now the mayor of Selma was black. 50 years ago, it was incomprehensible to believe that the United States would ever have an African-American as president. Now President Obama was serving his second term. These were changes that every American has a right to be proud of. But there was another reality that those gathered in Selma knew. While the African-American community has made huge advances in politics, and while the United States was much less of a racist society than it had been, there were still enormous economic and social problems facing the black community. The Voting Rights Act that John Lewis, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and others had fought so hard to pass had recently been gutted by a Supreme Court decision. And all across the country, Republican governors and legislators were rolling back the clock and making it harder for blacks and others to vote. The unemployment rate, especially among young people, was much, much too high. In some communities, the real unemployment rate for recent black high school graduates was 30 to 40%. Too many urban schools were nothing more than dropout factories, and too few young African Americans were making it through college. The African American situation with regard to criminal justice was a national disgrace. Jails from coast to coast were filled with African Americans, many of whom lacked decent education or job skills appropriate for the 21st century. Unbelievably, if present trends continue, 1 out of 4 black males born today would end up in jail. During the campaign, I met frequently with members of the Black Lives Matter movement. This loosely knit organization was successfully educating the nation that in many black communities, the police were not there protecting the people, but intimidating them. And time again, tragically, cell phone video cameras were recording horrific examples of extreme police brutality, the taking of innocent lives by overly aggressive police action. The names of the victims were becoming household names: Sandra Bland, Michael Brown, Rekia Boyd, Eric Garner, Walter Scott, Freddie Gray, Jessica Hernandez, Tamir Rice, Jonathan Farrell, Oscar Grant, Antonio Zambrano Montes, Samuel DuBose, Anastasio Hernandez Rojas, and many others. Each of them died unarmed at the hands of police officers or in police custody. Yes, there was no question that as a nation, we had made great advances in civil rights, but there was also no doubt in my mind that much, much more needed to be done. During the campaign, working with civil rights advocates, we introduced the strongest criminal justice reform any candidate had ever presented. It was now April 2015. Over the past 18 months, I had visited 12 states, given dozens of speeches, and sat through countless media interviews. I had spoken to many thousands of people and met privately with hundreds more. The time was rapidly approaching when we would have to make a very simple decision. Was there sufficient support for me to run a credible national campaign? Could we put together an effective political organization to mount that campaign? Bottom line, do I run for president of the United States? My mind went back to Burlington, Vermont in 1981. It all sounded familiar. Nobody then thought that the city's political and economic establishment could be beaten. They were just too powerful. Nobody thought that we could put together the kind of coalition that we did. How can you get police officers, environmentalists, low-income tenants, college students, and city employees to be part of the same movement? Nobody, absolutely nobody, thought we could win that election. But we did. We pulled off the biggest political upset in the modern history of Vermont, and over the next 8 years went about the business of putting our ideas into effect and transforming the city. But clearly, what we were talking about now was not Burlington, Vermont. This was not a small city in a small state. This was the United States of America, a diverse nation of 320 million people in 50 states. In the few national polls in which my name had been included, I'd barely registered. I had virtually no national name recognition, very little money, no political organization, and in most states of the country, my staff and I knew absolutely nobody. Nobody. We would be taking on the entire political establishment. Not one of my Senate colleagues, not one member of Congress, not one governor, not one mayor had told me that he or she would be supportive if I ran. Not one. Were we totally crazy to be even thinking about this? Maybe. But then I thought about the inspiring people I had met from one end of this country to the other, the many thousands who had come out to our meetings and enthusiastically supported a run. That was real, absolutely real. There was nothing crazy about them. Maybe the inside the Beltway pundits didn't know they existed, but I had seen them and heard them. They were people who were hurting, people who were tired of the status quo, people who loved this country but knew that we could be much more than we were, people who didn't want Hillary Clinton but wanted real political change and were prepared to fight for it. If I didn't run, I would be letting them down. There was a strong feeling growing within me that if I didn't run, it would be something that I would regret for the rest of my life. I was ready to do it. But wait a minute. A decision of this magnitude was not going to be made based on political calculations or on my feelings alone. There are a whole lot of very personal matters that had to be considered as well. If I ran, the campaign would have a huge impact upon my family, my wife Jane, my kids, Levy, Heather, Dave, and Karina, and their families, including my 7 grandchildren. It would also impact the staff at my Senate office, who would have to pick up the extra work that my absence would entail. Let me be honest. Jane was not enthusiastic about the idea of a presidential campaign. Never was. She is smart and a realist. She knew that if I ran, it would obviously mean that our family life would be radically altered. As Vermont senator, I am back in the state almost every weekend. As a presidential candidate, I would almost always be on the road and away from home. It would also mean that we would be living in a world of stress 7 days a week. She also worried about how, if against all odds we actually won, we could survive politically against the unprecedented hostility that was sure to come from Wall Street, the corporate world and their media, the Republican Party, and many Democrats. What we were trying to do was unprecedented in American history. We were taking on the entire political and economic establishment. If we won, what would happen the day after the election? Jane and I also knew what modern politics is about and the kind of ugly personal attacks, lies, and distortions that we and the entire family would inevitably have to endure. In Vermont, where there is much less political ugliness than is the case nationally, we had already experienced it. What would it be like at the national level when we'd face well-funded adversaries who paid operatives whose sole function was to destroy their opponents? It was just one more factor to take into consideration. While we were closing in on the decision of whether or not to make the run, Jane and I had breakfast at a Denny's restaurant in South Burlington, Vermont. We often went there on weekends. Their blueberry pancakes are especially good. While we were there that Sunday morning, a man came over to our table and movingly thanked me for the work that my office had done for him in gaining his veterans' benefits. Our efforts had changed his life. He urged me to run for president. Jane started crying. She now knew what we had to do. In early April, we invited Tad Devine, a national media and political consultant who had worked on 2 of my Vermont campaigns, to come to our home in Burlington to describe what a presidential campaign would entail. I am not much into national political consultants, and Tad is the only one I have ever worked with. Unlike Jane and me, Tad actually knew what a national campaign was about. He had been involved in Al Gore's run for the presidency in 2000, as well as a number of other presidential campaigns. Tad went down the checklist of what a campaign would mean. He talked about the tens of millions that would have to be raised, the scheduling requirements, staffing, security issues, how best to relate to national and state media, and the kind of paid media program that he thought we would need. He also believed that we would have to very heavily focus on Iowa and New Hampshire. If we made the decision to go forward, he was prepared to be part of the team. In the following weeks, Jane and I talked to Levy, Heather, Karina, and Dave to get their feelings about a possible campaign. Without exception, they were on board and wanted to help out in any way they could. In fact, they were pretty excited. On April 30th, 2015, I strolled into an area outside the Capitol and informally told the Beltway media that I would soon be filing papers to establish a presidential campaign exploratory committee. Quietly, we decided that we would formally begin the campaign on May 26th in Burlington. Chapter 4. How do you run a presidential campaign? The great anxiety that I had when I was contemplating running for president was that if I ran a poor campaign, if we were unable to get our message out effectively, if we failed to get a significant number of votes, if the actual campaign itself malfunctioned, we would be doing a disservice to the shared vision of the progressive movement. If our campaign was unsuccessful, the message left to history would be that our ideas were rejected and that nobody supported our agenda. More than anything else, that is what I feared. Well, how do you run an effective national campaign? How do you make sure you don't fall flat on your face and call it quits 2 months after you begin, which is not uncommon? We hadn't a clue. Vermont is a small state of 630,000 people. In my re-election campaign for the Senate in 2012, I received 207,000 votes, 71% of the total. We knew how to run good campaigns in Vermont and how to win there. We knew nothing about national campaigns and how to compete effectively in 50 states and a bunch of territories. We were about to learn a lot and quickly. The one thing I did know was that if we were going to be successful, we had to remain true to ourselves. We would not be slick or cute or poll-driven. We knew whom we were fighting for and whom we were fighting against. We could lose the election, but we would not lose our soul. Campaigns are about organizational capabilities, fundraising, press relations, advertising, and a million other details. But what I always knew in my heart is the most important part of any successful campaign is the message. What do you believe? What are you prepared to fight for? The message. For me, that was the easy part. I knew what the message would be. No consultant, no pollster had to tell me. It was the same message I had been delivering my entire life. We had to listen to and express to the public the real pain of the people, the working families of our country, the elderly, the children, the sick, the poor, and the young. These are the people who don't make campaign contributions, who don't know how to manipulate the system, who are almost always ignored by government. We had to tell the truth about what was really going on in our country, a truth hardly addressed by corporate media. We had to forcefully take on the arrogance and greed of the ruling class, a small number of powerful people who wanted it all. Further, and uniquely in modern campaigns, we had to put together a strong grassroots movement in which people understand that of course it was important that we elect a progressive president, but it was equally important that we create a political revolution by involving millions of new people in the process. People who are prepared to stand up and fight back against a corrupt political and economic system. In other words, this was not going to be a typical campaign. It was not just about electing a candidate. It was the building of a movement. It was the understanding that no president alone could or should do it all. The working families and the young people of this country had to be involved. Our campaign was also determined to think big, not small. We were prepared to raise the issues that most of the campaigns would not go near, issues that were far removed from ordinary American political discourse. I have always believed that asking the right questions was far more important than giving the right answers, and this campaign would ask the right questions. In that regard, I was very much helped and guided by Pope Francis and the role he was playing throughout the world. To my mind, Pope Francis was distinguishing himself as one of the great moral and religious leaders, not only of our time, but of modern history. He was opening up the entire world to new perspectives. His focus on the dispossessed, the poor, the elderly, and the unemployed, who are being cast aside by country after country, was awakening the conscience of the entire planet. His call for a moral economy, an economy that addressed the needs of ordinary people and not just capitalist profiteers, was also inspiring millions. I had the opportunity to hear the Pope when he spoke at both the White House and the Congress during his visit to Washington. In April 2016, I was invited to attend a conference in the Vatican on the need to create a moral economy. I had to take time off the campaign trail to go to Italy, but it was an opportunity that I did not want to miss. While there, I was able to briefly meet with the Pope and some impressive leaders of the Catholic Church. Pope Francis's mission had helped inspire me to think big. For decades now, especially with the ascendancy of right-wing republicanism and the growing conservatism of the Democratic Party, Congress had been thinking smaller and smaller. Too often, the debate in Washington centered on questions like, which program for the poor should we cut? Should we lower spending on Medicaid or food stamps? Should we slash education or affordable housing? Or, conversely, how much should we give in tax breaks to wealthy people who don't need them? How many more billions should we put into military spending? The great challenges of our time were being ignored. Big ideas, from the progressive perspective at least, were not being discussed. Our campaign would change that. Among other approaches, we would inject the radical concept of morality into the campaign. Further, we would look at what other countries around the world were doing to protect their working families and ask, why isn't the wealthiest nation on earth, the United States of America, doing the same? Once you think about it for a minute, you realize that this is not a very complicated approach. It is simple, straightforward, honest, and it reaches people. It changes the entire nature of the discussion. Is it moral that when millions of seniors are unable to afford the medicine they need, the top 0.1% owns as much wealth as the bottom 90%? Is it moral that when we have the highest rate of childhood poverty of almost any major country in the world, the 20 wealthiest people in this country have more wealth than the bottom half of America, 160 million people? Is it moral that when our citizens are working longer hours for lower wages, 52% of all new income generated today is going to the top 1%. And let's take a hard look at what's going on in the rest of the world. My Republican colleagues in the Senate often talk about, quote, American exceptionalism. Well, they're right, but not for the reasons they think. It turns out that the United States is exceptional in being far, far behind many other nations in addressing the basic needs of working families. Why is the United States the only major country on earth not to guarantee health care to all people as a right? If the United Kingdom, France, Germany, Scandinavia, and Canada could do it, why can't we? Why do our people work the longest hours of almost any people in the industrialized world, despite the explosion of technology and huge increases in worker productivity? Why do we have much shorter vacation time than any other major country? Why is the United States one of the very few countries in the world, including the vast majority of poor countries, not to provide paid family and medical leave? Why do working-class women in this country have to separate themselves from their newborn babies and return to work just 1 or 2 weeks after giving birth? At a time when almost everyone understands that human development is largely shaped during the first 4 years of life, why do we have one of the most dysfunctional and ineffective childcare systems in the world? Why does the United States have more people in jail than any other country? Why are we spending $80 billion a year to lock up 2.2 million Americans, disproportionately African American, Latino, and Native American? Why is higher education in America far more expensive than in any other country? How does it happen that Germany, Scandinavia, and other countries can provide free tuition at their colleges, while hundreds of thousands of young Americans cannot afford to get a higher education because of the cost? These were just some of the questions we intended to ask. I was comfortable with our message. The next question was, how do we get the word out? Rallies. From day one, I knew that rallies and public meetings would be an essential component of the campaign. Why? Mostly, I must confess, because I love doing them, and always have. As Vermont's congressman and senator, I am quite sure that I have held far more official congressional town meetings, many, many hundreds of them over the years, than any other elected office holder in the history of our state. We hold them in the state's largest cities, Burlington, Rutland, Colchester, Brattleboro, Bennington, and Montpelier, and in towns with populations of 200 or less. Usually somewhere between 1 and 300 people come out for the meetings. Pretty good turnouts for a small rural state. In addition, during my election races in Vermont, rallies are always the cornerstone of the campaign. Sometimes we do 3 or 4 in a day, going from town to town. The format is pretty simple. We meet in a school, church, town hall. The event begins with a performance by local musicians. We serve hamburgers and hot dogs or some other simple fare. A few local supporters on a panel then get up and speak briefly about issues of concern to the community and why they are supporting me. I speak for a half hour or so, take questions from the audience, and move on. And that's it. I love town meetings and rallies for a simple reason. It gives me an opportunity to interact with ordinary people and to find out what's on their minds. I am able to communicate with them directly without the filter of the media. Moms and dads are there with their kids. People of all ages and backgrounds show up. These public events energize me. It's what democracy is all about. I have a poster of Norman Rockwell's painting of a Vermont town meeting right on the wall of the front entrance to my Burlington office. We were going to make rallies and town meetings the central part of our presidential campaign. However, not just because I love doing them, but because I believe that's what democracy was all about. We were going to do a large number of rallies and town meetings because they generated excitement and energy and would win us votes. It was good politics. Today, much of what elections are about is the raising of outrageous sums of money, hiring consultants, polling, and doing television ads. In fact, many candidates spend more time raising money than doing anything else. In large states like California, television advertising is pretty much all that a statewide campaign is about. There is very little face-to-face contact with the voters. A candidate is just another product being sold. On top of that, because of Citizens United, there are campaigns where, quote, independent expenditures play a more important role than does the actual candidate. As insane as this may sound, outside special interests can have more influence in developing positive and negative themes, raising money, and putting ads on the air than the real-life candidate. In a campaign like that, the average voter is really voting for the unknown donors behind the independent expenditures, not the person on the ballot. Our campaign, to say the least, was going to be different. We were not going to have independently financed super PACs telling people what I believed or didn't believe or demonizing my opponents. I was going to be the person expressing my views, and to as great a degree as possible, I would be stating those views before real people. I wanted to put energy, spontaneity, and messiness back into the political process, not just a well-choreographed set of productions or listening tours carefully made for TV. One of the goals of our campaign was to bring people together, not just metaphorically, but in the flesh. The pundits in the establishment may not have thought so, but I have always felt that the ideas I was espousing were not radical or fringe. They were mainstream, the views that millions held. The truth is that when people come into a room or a gymnasium or an arena and they look around them and see all the other people in that venue sharing those same views, they come away strengthened and energized. They are not alone. They are part of something bigger than themselves. They are part of a movement. This is especially true in the audiences of diverse backgrounds, which became increasingly true as our campaign progressed. A rally of thousands of people standing together, blacks, whites, Latinos, Native Americans, Asian Americans, young and old, gay and straight, people who immigrated here and those born here. This is something unforgettable and extraordinarily powerful. It is not something that a television ad can accomplish. Further, in the smaller states, rallies become a key part of our Get Out the Vote effort. If you go to a small town and 500 people come out, everyone in the town will know that you were there. That is especially true if you visit, as we did, rural or remote areas where most politicians never go. In New Hampshire, for example, we held 68 public meetings and spoke to 41,810 people. In winning that state handily, I received 151,584 votes. While there is no doubt that some people attended our meetings more than once, that means that approximately one out of four people who voted for me actually heard me in person. That is what grassroots democracy is all about, and I love it. In Iowa, we held 101 meetings with over 73,000 people attending. The total number of votes cast in Iowa was about 171,000. In the Iowa caucus, we won about half the delegates and believe that we may have won a small majority of the votes cast. In California, in an effort that was unprecedented in modern history, we spoke to over 274,000 people at 46 rallies throughout the state. There was probably nobody in Congress who had more experience with town meetings and rallies than I did. We were going to learn soon, however, that rallies and public events for our presidential campaign were a little bit different from what we were used to in Vermont. Staffing. It is a political truism that you can't run a good campaign without a good staff. And here we had a particular problem that other campaigns did not have. If you are a liberal, moderate, or conservative Democrat, if you are a traditional candidate, there are many excellent and experienced political operatives around the country whom you can hire, who have experience in those worlds. There are consulting firms, Democratic and Republican, that get involved in campaigns every 2 years. Some of them are excellent and staffed by highly skilled and experienced professionals. But what if you are a Democratic Socialist, running a kind of campaign that no one else has ever attempted to run? What models do you build upon? Whom do you hire? First, we attempted to get the best ideas we could from staff that had been involved in recent progressive campaigns. While our campaign would be different, there was no sense in reinventing the wheel. Three campaigns that we got good advice from were those of Jesse Jackson, Dennis Kucinich, and Barack Obama. I had supported Jesse Jackson for president in 1988, and I have always believed that his campaign was enormously important in breaking down barriers and opening up new political space in our country. His concept of the Rainbow Coalition played a transformative role in American politics. Frankly, Barack Obama would not have been elected president without the groundbreaking work of Jackson's campaigns. Further, not only was Jackson a brilliant and charismatic campaigner, which I saw firsthand when I campaigned with him in Vermont, but he ran a smart, guerrilla-type campaign that did remarkably well given the limited financial resources he had. We got useful advice from some of the veterans who had worked with him, and from time to time I would chat with Reverend Jackson on the phone. His son Jonathan also spoke at a number of our rallies. Dennis Kucinich is an old friend of mine. We met each other back in the 80s when he was mayor of Cleveland and I was mayor of Burlington. We were two of the most progressive mayors in the country at that time. Later, we worked closely together when we both served in the U.S. House. Throughout his political career, Dennis has always shown an enormous amount of courage and never forgot the poor background he came from. Dennis ran for president in 2004 and 2008. The fact that he never received a whole lot of votes in his campaigns understates the impact that he has had on contemporary politics. During his campaigns for president, Dennis created a strong grassroots movement and forced the debate in the Democratic primary process into a direction it never would have gone without him. Before the campaign began, Jane and I had the opportunity to meet with him and his wife, Elizabeth, and to tap their brains as to what we could learn from his two campaigns. They were very helpful in discussing issues related to fundraising, staffing, and transportation. Howard Dean, a fellow Vermonter, ran in the Democratic primary in 2004. His campaign developed a number of important political breakthroughs that we learned from and utilized. He was the first candidate to successfully fundraise online, and his concept of meetups or house parties was a very innovative concept that we built upon. In 2008, a young U.S. Senator from Illinois, Barack Obama, ran one of the most brilliant campaigns in the modern history of our country. While he was more conservative than Jackson, Kucinich, or myself, there was much to be learned from Obama's campaign. He utilized social media for communication and fundraising in a way that no one had before. He held large and effective rallies across the country. And he tapped into the cultural energy of some of the most creative people in America, a greatly underutilized resource. As we prepared, we spoke to many people who had been involved in Obama's campaigns. Not only did we learn a lot from them, such as how to best campaign in Iowa, we eventually brought more than a few on board. A non-traditional, unprecedented type of campaign required a non-traditional campaign manager. That turned out to be Jeff Weaver, the owner of a small comic book store in Virginia, who had never been involved in a national campaign. I met Jeff 30 years ago when, as a young man, he came into my campaign office to volunteer on my 1986 gubernatorial campaign. He came to us with very good qualifications. Not only was he a former Marine, he had been thrown out of Boston University for his civil rights activism. That worked for me. Jeff was born and raised in northern Vermont and eventually graduated from the University of Vermont. In 1988, during my congressional campaign, we didn't have a lot of money. We made up for it with hard work and long hours on the campaign trail. Jeff drove me around the state in his car from morning to night, often 7 days a week. I am confident that I am the only congressional candidate in history to have as his official campaign car a Yugo. It was an unforgettable car, which, when it went above 55 miles per hour, started rattling. In 1990, when we won the congressional race, Jeff went with me to Washington. He is a hard worker and extremely smart. Over the years, he advanced his way up in the office and eventually became my chief of staff. In 2006, he managed my campaign for the Senate, and when we won, he moved over there with me. Over the years, Jeff married, had three great kids, and picked up a law degree from Georgetown. Unlike every political observer in the world, Jeff believed from day one that we had a real chance to win the election, and he ran the campaign on that basis. Jeff was at the center of our campaign wheel's many spokes. He had to coordinate the fundraising and the budgeting, the hiring and firing of key staff, and the transferring of some of them as new primaries and caucuses came on the horizon. He was involved in the production of paid media and when and where to air the ads, as well as organizing rallies and handling security issues. His legal skills were also helpful when it came to dealing with the DNC and the Democratic establishment. Jeff is a good writer, and on some issues like criminal justice, where he is particularly knowledgeable, he helped me prepare speeches. He also became a regular on television shows as he became one of the strongest defenders of me and the campaign against the attacks that were coming our way from the Clinton camp. Running a campaign, especially ours, is an insane experience that one can never be fully prepared for. Jeff did a great job. Warren Gunnels has been a key policy advisor of mine going back to when I was in the House. He kindly took a leave of absence from the Senate, where he served as my staff director as the ranking member on the Budget Committee, to plunge into the campaign. As chief policy advisor, Warren played an outstanding role in researching and writing speeches and position papers on a wide range of economic issues, from Wall Street to healthcare to infrastructure. Warren is an extraordinarily hard worker who, no matter what the obstacles, always gets the job done. Michael Briggs is a former writer for the Chicago Sun-Times, has been my communications director since I entered the Senate 10 years ago, and has done a great job. Michael is one of the hardest workers I've ever known. He is on call morning, noon, and night, 7 days a week, which is how I often work. Michael wanted to go where the action was, and when I announced for president, he took a leave from the Senate office to join the campaign full-time. He was at my side every moment of the campaign, dealing with national and local media and arranging my many interviews and media appearances. In every campaign, there is one person who is the go-to guy. For much of our campaign, that person was Shannon Jackson, a young man from Vermont who had formerly worked in my Senate office. Shannon was there to coordinate scheduling, flights, food, and all the other essentials that had to be taken care of. Jane and the kids. The campaign became a family affair, with Jane and the kids playing a very active role. Jane, who served as my chief of staff for a while when I was in the House, knows politics and media very well. In this campaign, she not only was a key advisor, but became a very visible media surrogate, appearing on many television and radio shows. She also campaigned for me in Alaska and Hawaii, both of which we won. She also showed the country that not everyone in the family is grumpy. The four kids were as involved as their schedules allowed. My oldest son, Levy, an advocate for low-income people, gave speeches for me in his home state of New Hampshire and played an invaluable role as a researcher who knows his way around the Internet. My daughter, Heather, a yoga teacher, somehow got me on the front page of yoga magazines and helped out as we campaigned in Arizona, where she now lives. My son, Dave, knows a whole lot of people in the arts community and did a great job in helping to create the art of a political revolution and bringing cultural energy into the campaign. My youngest daughter, Karina, did a bit of speaking, set up some of the administrative structures in the campaign, and made sure we were always greeted with family and good food when we made it home. Karina, Dave, and Liza worked together to take care of family and home matters, not an insignificant thing when you're always on the road. They all joined us as we crisscrossed the country, bringing the love and support necessary for us to maintain a nonstop schedule. Everyone on the campaign particularly enjoyed it when the grandkids came. Social media. I am 75 years of age. I grew up with newspapers, radio, television, and books. The editorial page and letters to the editor were important to me, and I have written my fair share of op-eds. When I was elected mayor of Burlington in 1981, there were no computers in City Hall and no video to record the city council meetings. There were no emails. Hard to believe, but we actually wrote individual letters to constituents. In my early Vermont campaigns, much of our communication with the media was through press releases that were sent via the postal system. We sent a release out on Monday, it got to the media on Wednesday, and if we were lucky, it got printed on Thursday. In case you haven't noticed, the world has changed. Personally, I'm a bit of a Luddite. I am not all that impressed with every aspect of modern technology. Too much change for the sake of change. And let me make the radical statement that I don't believe that you can say something profound in the 140 characters that make up a tweet. But I'm not dumb. As a congressman, as a senator, it didn't take me long to understand the advantages of modern communications technology. It also made sense to hire young people for my office who knew what they were doing. Originally, Jeff Franks set up our Senate office social media. He was joined in 2013 by Kenneth Pennington, who greatly expanded our efforts. Despite representing one of the smallest states in the country, by 2014, my Senate office had a greater presence on Facebook, Twitter, and the other social media than almost any other congressional office. We were also ahead of the curve in the use of email, video, and conference calling. With regard to the presidential campaign, we knew from the beginning that the internet and social media would be important tools for us in terms of communication and raising money. We just didn't know how important they would be. We started the establishment of our campaign's digital team by bringing on some of the bright young people we had in our Senate office who were doing social media there. Kenneth Pennington led that effort and was joined by Hector Segala. We then interviewed a number of people and organizations to broaden what we could accomplish online. We settled on Revolution Messaging, a well-respected company with leaders like Scott Goodstein, who had worked on Obama's campaign and for progressive organizations. Revolution jump-started our online fundraising and advertising efforts. The first day of the campaign, we signed up 100,000 people and raised $1.5 million, with Tim Tagaris leading the fundraising effort at Revolution. Aaron Shorthary led an excellent team, including Hillary Hess, Fred Geria, Eric Olofsson, and Peter O'Leary, who captured the excitement of the rallies on video so that Hector could spread them far and wide on social media. And we built a community with millions of people receiving our emails, in large part due to online advertisements driven by Keegan Gudis, another one of the Revolution partners. From the beginning, we knew it was important to fund this campaign differently than most. We weren't going to be receiving a whole lot of support from wealthy donors, and we didn't want a super PAC. In the end, 94% of our money came in from online. And we not only talked the talk about campaign finance reform, we walked the walk. But we didn't use the internet just to raise money. As an example, on July 29, 2015, I was able to speak to more than 110,000 supporters at 3,700 house parties held in every state in the country. What an extraordinary and powerful organizing tool. We were able to live stream many of the rallies and town meetings that we held. Almost every week, we were sending out short videos on some of the most important issues facing the country, and millions of people viewed them and passed them on to their friends. Every single day, messages on issues of the day and events we were holding went out to millions. When people talk about how well we did with young people, clearly one of the reasons for that was our success with social media. Social media enabled us to talk directly to an entire generation about the most important issues facing their lives and start an online discussion about them. Needless to say, that was far more effective for us than short sound bites on television or the political gossip that I often had to respond to from the corporate media. Further, as part of our social media success, I learned something that never in a million years would have occurred to me, but is now part of many modern campaigns. As a result of the growth of our social media network, our campaign began running a quite large and lucrative merchandise marketing company. Yes, while we were busy trying to transform the economic and political life of the nation, we were also selling T-shirts, sweatshirts, hats, mugs, buttons, bumper stickers, and all kinds of other paraphernalia. In fact, for a while, I believe we were the major source of business for union-made T-shirts in the United States. But we weren't the only ones making money off of campaign products. We had unleashed an entrepreneurial volcano. Who said I was bad for capitalism? In Vermont, the teddy bear company was making Bernie bears. There was even an action doll, not to mention underwear, many styles of shirts, shopping bags, and a million different kinds of buttons. When we began the campaign, we had high expectations of what we could do through social media, but they paled in terms of what we actually accomplished in terms of communication and fundraising. We ended up with some 5 million Facebook friends and more than 3 million followers on Twitter. Through the internet, we received a record-breaking 8 million individual campaign contributions from 2.5 million contributors. I think it's fair to say that we wrote the book for progressive politics in terms of showing the potential of social media. Volunteer coordination. One of the challenges that we faced was that we were taking on virtually the entire Democratic establishment. And I mean the entire Democratic establishment. Before Hillary Clinton even formally announced her intention to seek the Democratic nomination, 8 months before the first vote was cast in Iowa, there were 400 superdelegates lined up to support her. In every state that we contested, we had to take on Democratic governors, members of Congress, senators, locally elected officials, and party leaders, and their organizational ability to bring out the vote. How do you take on the entire political establishment, especially in states where you start off by knowing almost nobody? You build a great volunteer organization. There is and was no question of seasoned politicians knowing how to get people to the polls. But our campaign had something that the Clinton campaign and the establishment didn't have, something that permeated every aspect of our campaign. We had energy, passion, and dedication. By the end of the campaign, through an enormous amount of effort, we were able to bring many hundreds of thousands of volunteers into the fight. Surrogates and organizational support. I am a United States senator. I am well known. I can attract a crowd at a rally. I can get on TV and radio pretty easily. I can do newspaper interviews. But in a presidential campaign, I can't be the only one out there in the public eye. We need help in spreading the message of the campaign. We need support from well-known and respected surrogates who can attract attention from the public and the media and give the campaign credibility. We need the support of large progressive organizations. Easier said than done. Normally in a national campaign, much of the surrogate help for a candidate comes from elected officials. A candidate goes into a city or a state and is joined by a governor, a senator, or a mayor. Clearly, that wasn't going to be the case for us. Almost all of the Democratic elected officials had already lined up behind Clinton. Our strategy was to effectively utilize those few elected officials who were prepared to support us, as well as political activists from the world of labor, environmental activism, academia, and social and racial justice organizations. Frankly, our surrogate support started slowly, but as the campaign gained momentum, we received more and more backing from extraordinary people. One of the joys of the campaign was working with them. The elected officials from Congress who signed on to the campaign were Senator Jeff Merkley, Representative Keith Ellison, Representative Tulsi Gabbard, Representative Raul Grijalva, Representative Marcy Kapta, and Representative Peter Welch. There are 46 Democrats in the Senate. We had one. There are 187 Democrats in the House. We had five. In the world of Democratic politics, it took real courage for each of these members to buck the Clinton organization, the party leadership, and the political establishment and join our campaign. Needless to say, some wealthy campaign contributors were not happy with their decisions. Jeff Merkley, a senator from Oregon, and I worked together over the years on a number of climate change and environmental issues. He is one of the most progressive members of the Senate. I was proud to have him on board. Representative Tulsi Gabbard of Hawaii joined our campaign in a rather dramatic fashion. She resigned as vice chair of the Democratic National Committee. Tulsi, a veteran of the war in Iraq, is deeply concerned about foreign and military policy. She saw the lives of too many of her comrades destroyed by a war we should never have gotten into, and she wanted policies to make sure that we never got into another such war again. The most progressive group in the U.S. House is the Progressive Caucus, with 71 members. It is also now the largest caucus within the House Democratic Party. When I entered the Congress in 1991, I helped create that organization. I thought it was important that there be a caucus that brought together members to focus on economic, social, racial, and environmental injustice. Today, the House Progressive Caucus is led by Congressman Keith Ellison and Raul Grijalva. They are both extraordinary members of Congress and are doing a great job chairing the caucus. I was proud when they both decided to join the campaign. Keith Ellison is one of the few Muslims in the U.S. Congress. During the early rise of Trumpism and the growing expression of anti-Muslim prejudice, I joined Keith and other Muslims for a public meeting in a mosque in Washington. It was a moving experience and a reminder that this is America. We should not be hating people because of their religion. Our goal throughout the campaign was to reach out to people of all religious faiths and all ethnic backgrounds. We ended up doing very well within the Muslim community, and Muslim votes, in fact, may have been the margin of victory for us in the Michigan primary. As a Jew, I was especially proud to be working with Muslims. Yes, we can come together. Raul Grijalva is an old friend of mine from Tucson, Arizona, and a leader in both the progressive and Latino communities. One of the most beautiful nights of the campaign was speaking at a rally before about 7,000 people at a baseball stadium in Tucson after having been introduced by Raul. It was one of the most diversely attended events of the campaign. The crowd was largely Latino, but many blacks and whites were there as well. Representative Marcy Kaptur and I have worked together for 25 years, starting when we served in the House together. Marcy represents Toledo, Ohio. She has seen her community devastated by disastrous trade agreements that have resulted in massive job losses. Marcy remains one of the strongest voices in Congress in demanding that we have trade agreements that work for American workers, not just the CEOs of large corporations. She was a key asset in our campaign. Representative Peter Welch succeeded me in the U.S. House when I won my seat in the Senate. He is a former president of the Vermont State Senate and someone I have known for almost 40 years. Over those years, he and I have worked together on many Vermont issues. It was comforting to hear Peter's down-home Vermont perspective on the campaign. Our campaign also attracted some great leaders from the local and state level. Nina Turner, a former state senator from Ohio and one of the most dynamic orators in America, came on board early and was extremely active throughout the campaign. Nina was a constant and brilliant spokesperson for us on TV and radio and introduced me at events throughout the country. Talk about courage. Nina took an enormous amount of heat from party officials in Ohio when she withdrew her support for Secretary Clinton and came on board our campaign. Nina's husband, Jeff, a Teamster, was also very helpful. Chuy Garcia is a county commissioner in Cook County, Chicago. I supported him when he ran against Rahm Emanuel for mayor of Chicago in 2015. In my campaign, he not only helped in Illinois, but traveled throughout the country, especially before Latino audiences. Chuy is a stand-up guy and has become a good friend. Why would black members of the South Carolina legislature, like Justin Bamberg, Terry Alexander, Joe Neal, and a few others, support a white socialist from Vermont who trailed Hillary Clinton by 50 points in the polls in their state? Well, you'll have to ask them, but that's what they did. In a conservative state like South Carolina, they showed enormous courage in doing so, and I'm deeply grateful to them. Truthfully, the problems and politics of the South are not something that I was familiar with when I began the campaign. I learned a lot, and these guys helped teach me. Celebrity support. For better or worse, well-known Hollywood personalities and other celebrities can and do play an important role in politics. And we had many of them actively involved in our campaign, including some very dedicated people who have spent much of their lives as political activists. There are many celebrities who simply enjoy the glow of fame and fortune. The people who participated in our campaign, however, use their name recognition and popularity to educate America about issues dear to their hearts and vitally important for the future of our country. Issues like poverty, racism, climate change, and the environment, immigration reform, voter suppression, peace, and many other concerns. It was a great thrill to be on the stage at the legendary Apollo Theater in Harlem in a panel discussion with the singer Harry Belafonte. who has been involved in progressive politics from his youth. I also had the opportunity to meet with him and his wife earlier, where he told me about some of the great work that he continues to do at age 90. Cornel West is a man of courage and brilliance. He is a prolific writer, an extraordinary orator, and a friend of mine. It is always a bit intimidating to get up on a stage after being introduced by Cornel. Dr. West was an important part of the campaign from coast to coast. One of America's most acclaimed actresses, Susan Sarandon, introduced me at rallies across the country and did events on her own. Jane and I had met Susan years before when she acted in the film Sweetheart's Dance in Vermont. Susan took heat from some of her Hollywood friends for supporting me. Her sincerity and down-to-earthness came across to the thousands of people she spoke to. Rosario Dawson, a passionate defender of the needs of low-income people, was on stage with me when we spoke to 18,000 people at a park in the South Bronx, one of the poorest communities in the country. Rosario played an important role throughout the campaign. Sarah Silverman is a brilliant comedian and was funny as hell when she introduced me to a crowd of 25,000 in Los Angeles. She created an amazing video supporting my candidacy that millions saw online, thanks to her extensive social media network. I am a big fan of Spike Lee and his movies. He created some fantastic videos and radio ads for the campaign, did an interview and photo shoot with me for the New York edition of The Hollywood Reporter, gave opening remarks at events, and even attended the Brooklyn debate. Danny DeVito introduced me at rallies on several occasions and got a better response than I did. Danny is one of my favorite actors and a real progressive.